Welcome back to Financial Therapy. It's not just about the money. I'm personal financial planner, columnist, and financial therapist, Rick Kaler. Research tells us that 90% of all financial decisions are made emotionally, not logically. For nearly four decades, I've been helping people make better money decisions. So what makes my financial worldview different from most financial experts? I blend the nuts and bolts of financial advice with the emotions that drive making them. Good money decisions are not just about the money. So let's get started with today's episode. Welcome back to another edition. And I'm continuing the chat with Jillian Knight, who is a LMFT, licensed therapist, in short. And we were talking about her experience with debt and specifically with the Dave Ramsey modality of doing that. And we're talking about, when we ended last time, that this was a punishment-based system. And that was to my question, well, you know, so what's wrong with what Dave Ramsey does? I mentioned him positively in a couple of my books. And so I am interested in hearing more about the downsides of the punishment system.
Yeah. So the way that I look at it is when you punish someone or you are punishing yourself for your behavior, so in this case financial behavior, you can shame yourself into changing your behavior, right? But generally that's only in the short term, and the likelihood of it being any sort of lasting long-term change is, I think, pretty small. And so when you think about sort of punishing and shaming people into changing, and then they get to this point, right, of paying off this debt, and then what are the chances that that is going to be a sustained lifestyle change? You know, you might sort of equate it to a diet in the same way, right? Where if you're trying to lose weight and you punish yourself by restricting what you're eating, you'll lose weight, but how likely is it that it's gonna stay off, right? And so with debt, how likely is it that you're gonna stay out of debt? Not that there's anything inherently wrong with debt, which is a whole other Dave Ramsey belief that all debt is bad and you should pay it off as soon as you can.
I am internally jumping up and down as I'm listening to you talk, in that it's something that I've said for a long time, is that, and I've experienced that shaming is really good for short term, can be really good for short term behavioral change, but no good for long term. And it brings up my involvement in a really conservative fundamentalist group. And that is the MO was guilt and shame, mostly shame, to help people help. I know the corporate line well. Change behavior for what is good for them, and what is good for them is what we decided would be good for them. And so, and I think a person needs to stay in that loop of shame to reinforce it, to continue the behavior. Because once the shame is not there anymore, the behavior can be hard to maintain. That makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, if you're not hearing that message over and over again, you can, I mean, you do start to, I feel like there is some significant degree of internalizing that shame to where that almost becomes your internal voice, which also sort of makes me think about parts and IFS and how that relates.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's one of your favorite things to talk about.
I think it's true that most all of us have an inner critic, which I think in the mental health field can be connected to caregivers, that we can replay those messages we heard. I mean, this is probably a silly example, but a few years ago, I was in the gym, in the locker room, I'm putting on my shoes, and I wear a brace in my shoes for flat feet. And so I'm getting dressed, and I take my braces out of my street shoes, because I'm done with my workout, and put them back into my workout shoes. And this voice goes, "Well, you dummy, why'd you just do that? You know, you already took them out of your workout shoes to put them in your street shoes. That's stupid." And I had done enough IFS by then to know, okay, I get this part of me that's trying to keep me from being criticized. Because for sure, somebody's going to go, "Well, that's really silly. So get him out of there as quick as you can." I looked around in the locker room. There was nobody in it. And it was such a realization to me that this was all internal.
Yeah.
This wasn't external. It was all internal. It was that critical voice, really concerned about somebody's going to criticize me for doing this, unaware that the place is vacant. So to your point, yeah, after a period of time, we can absolutely shame ourselves. And I think having come out of something that I will call cult-like, if not a cult myself, that those voices can stay with a person. That critic, right, can be active for a long, long time. Until we make friends with it. And that's something that if I'd heard that 10, 15 years ago, I said, this guy's nuts. I mean, we want to get rid of the critical part, right?
Right. That's a load of crap.
Right. And the other thing that you said that I just gets me excited too, is I have a course I teach for our community. And in it, I talk about deprivation, and that deprivation financially doesn't work any better than deprivation with a diet, right? You don't cut down to 700 calories a day and do that for 3 years.
Yeah. So it's like, I think what I would tell someone really is like, if they were sort of where I was, but they don't see any other way, right? Because the other thing is, like, when you're in it, you think that this is like the best thing ever and everyone should be doing it, and you defend against anybody who questions it. And that's how it maintains its power. So much like a cult. I would say that's not the only way, and that you don't have to feel so bad in order to improve your financial situation, right? Because I thought that I could just sort of shame myself into doing better with money, and that it was my fault that I was where I was with money, which now I know is only partly true. So and I think because we talk about shame, but like, you know, shame being not just like that you are bad with money, but that you're like a bad person. Like that it's not just like you made a mistake with money or like you've made some bad financial decisions, because that's like separate from the person, but this makes you feel like I am bad or I've done something bad. And that just like, it doesn't need to be that way.
And you bring out another great point, which is that difference between guilt and shame, which are often used in the same sentence as meaning the same thing. It's kind of like a millionaires and billionaires used in the same sentence. There is a huge difference between a millionaire and a billionaire.
Yeah.
And just for our listeners, and correct me if I'm wrong, guilt is when I've done something wrong. I literally have done something wrong. I made a bad decision. And it can be something I can say, okay, I made a bad decision. I won't do that again. Mm-hmm. Where shame, to your point, says maybe I made the bad decision, but I made the bad decision because I am a really bad person. I am really deficient.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I like to quote Brené Brown, right? She does a lot of guilt versus shame work, or she does a lot of shame research. And so she says guilt is I did something bad, and shame is I am bad.
Yes. Yep.
And she also says, which is relevant here, that shame thrives in secrecy. And so there is this level of like you are, it's interesting because you're part of, like when you're in the plan, doing the plan, like you're part of this community sort of, but also you're not doing a whole lot of enjoyable things. So you're really not, you're sort of isolated at the same time. And so like you're not really sharing this shame with anyone, so it's sort of just thriving while you're doing this thing of paying down this debt. And then the other thing is that sort of the antidote to shame is empathy, right? And so if people are feeling really, people are already feel bad about money, right? So there's people already feel in general, even if you've never heard of Dave Ramsey before, there's so much shame around money already. And then you sort of add this shaming approach on top of it. It sort of just compounds the shaming when what would be more helpful would be an empathetic approach, right? Where the shame can't live anymore because of how much empathy you've sort of poured onto it.
I'm guessing that in that community, if you shared your shame, you're probably not going to get empathy. I can think of being in the community I was in. If I had mentioned anything about shame I was feeling about what we were doing, or any shame about one of the tenets of the group, like paying off the small debt first, or whatever it'd be, I'm probably not going to get empathy.
No, and that's the thing, though. It sort of focuses on it. It's not, there's no real, and you know, it's been what, three years? So I guess it really hasn't been that long. I feel like it's been a while, but also not very long at all. It's very strange. COVID did that. It's not discussed as an emotional thing. right? Like there's no real mention of emotions, which you and I know how emotional money is and can be. And yet, you know, the plan is very logical and there are these steps and you follow these steps. And as long as you follow the steps and you continue to regurgitate the steps to other people, then you can have some sense of control, or like you can feel less sort of just, you can try to feel less emotional about it because you have a plan and you're just going to stick to the plan. Right.
Yeah.
But it totally just like doesn't even touch all the other stuff that we know is there.
I could, that makes a lot of sense, that part of me that was involved in that type of thinking, because mm-hmm. emotions were, I won't say emotions were evil, but emotions were not to be trusted. It wasn't about emotions. It was about logic. And actually, emotions can really mess you up and make you can make illogical decisions if with emotions.
Patriarchal.
Yeah.
That sounds quite patriarchal, Rick.
Yeah. Well, you talk about drinking Kool-Aid. I know how to drink Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Back in the day, that was 30 years ago, 35 years ago, maybe. But it's a pretty tightly knit mindset. And I'm guessing, I have no idea. Do you know the Enneagram or aware of the Enneagram?
Yeah. Yeah.
Simon.
I mean, I haven't done like intensive trainings into it, but I have a general idea of most of the numbers and my own.
Yeah. I'm a type, I fixate around a type one, which is the reformer, loves to teach, loves to be right. Mm. And has a cause. I don't know if you can see any of that in me or not, but
just a little bit.
I have a hunch Dave Ramsey's probably a one. A lot of that, financial planners, you know, and we have all nine energies in us. And I know Russ Hudson, who's my teacher, would be gagging right now listening to me say this, because he's very adamant the Enneagram is not a typing mechanism. It's a mechanism for personal growth,
right,
and becoming present. And right. I fully subscribe to that. And I think it's important to understand the types. It helps me with my clients when I can see those energies. So when we first talked about this, you talked about investing and that Dave didn't really stress investing until your debt is paid off. And when he does stress investing, it's sometimes it isn't really good advice. Mm-hmm. And that's what really opened my eyes. I've never taken his course. I've never taught. I've heard him on the radio, which is where I was. I was introduced there, and his new people that did his debt thing, and so I did say positive things about his approach to debt, not knowing the other side of the story that you present. But when I heard him the third time on the radio saying, now, you need to stay away from them REITs, which are real estate investment trusts, and just stick with them good growth mutual funds, because them REITs have really, really terrible fees and you can't earn anything from them, but you stick with good growth mutual funds. And I heard that about the third time I went back to my office. I pulled off of Morningstar the returns of real estate investment trusts versus good growth mutual funds. And I'm talking about publicly held REITs. And they beat the mutual funds 1, 3, 5, and 10 years. And I sent that to him. And saying, Dave, and thinking the best, here's some data. You might want to update your data. It might have been true 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's not true now. And I received a call from his attorneys that told me I will, and I wrote this in a blog, and you probably can still find the blog on my website, Financial Awakenings. And if you can't, it's on YouTube. And all you have to do is put in Ramsey Kaler, which I just did. I had a lot darker hair back then. This is 15 years ago. And the audio of that, I go through the audio of the column. And I was kind of amused by that because I'm thinking, well, he's a public figure. They said that he copyrighted his name. I couldn't use it. And to take down my blog post. Well, I didn't. And you can get on and read. There's 98 comments here, most of them telling you that I would be the last person you ought to listen to when it comes to money. Okay. And there's another one I put on here. I think it's called Dave is Not a Moron. And that's when I was going down the streets many months later, and he said, you know, there's some people recently criticizing me and talked about the same thing I had talked about. Mm. He said, they're a moron. And I put it a lot better in the thing. So I wrote another column on that, and I wrote another column on you can retire by taking 8% withdrawals. And none of these were enjoyed by Dave. And that kind of surprised me and gave me a glimpse as to what's going on. Because as a financial professional, I want to be giving out good information. I want my data to be correct. And if the data suggests I've been wrong, well, then I was wrong. And that wasn't the attitude that Dave met this data with. Mm-hmm. So, and I went through in that third one, how if you took out 8% withdrawals, how you'd be broke in 10 years as a retiree, because that's not sustainable. There's not a financial planner. That's a real financial planner that would agree with that. It's 3 to 4%. I mean, that's just like universal knowledge. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my history with Dave.
Yeah, I was very interested to hear about that. For sure.
Yeah, and when you were talking about the student loans, there's someone who is well known in the financial planning circles called, his name is Michael Kitsis. And he did an actual study and comparison of should you pay off debt versus invest it. And I was quite surprised. He even went up to rates as high as, if I remember right, 6 or 8%, and showed how a younger person would be ahead to invest that money rather than pay down the debt, especially when you can write it off in retirement plans. And I've had clients with 2% student loans with $400,000 worth. And my suggestion, both physicians, we are not paying that debt off early at all. Mm-hmm. Because this is a gift at 2%. Theoretically, you can invest that and earn 5 or 6%. Yeah. So I'm guessing that Dave would not go along with that.
Oh, no, not even close. No, and that's one of the problems is the advice hasn't changed. from when it first started, despite what this was maybe the his plan first come up in the early 90s, I want to say.
Okay. Wow.
So it's still $1,000 in an emergency fund. Pay out all your debt, smallest to largest, except for your house. Start investing in retirement. Save for a down payment on a house. Save for kids' college. Pay off your mortgage early. I try not to think about the steps anymore. So, but that's sort of the idea.
It's just a one size fits all. It's very, very rigid, right?
Right.
We have a few minutes left. I mean, what's the thinking? What's the mentality? What's going on with a person that, I don't know, is doubling down in the face of facts? I mean, they wouldn't view it that way.
Yeah, I think part of it is that it, so there are other aspects of it that, so there, you've got the financial aspects, right, that you're speaking to. You've got the mental and emotional aspects that I've brought up. There's also a religious component that, you know, it is based in evangelical Christianity. And so there is, for some people, this, because he does include tithing in your budget, right? So it's, he incorporates religion and sort of passages from the Bible to sort of bolster his thinking on these things and what he sort of preaches. And like the borrower is slave to the lender is something you'll hear him say. And so if you don't want to be a slave to the lender anymore, pay off all your debt, right? And so there's the use of religion. There's also, it's really targeted at sort of lower income, lower education level, right? So it, especially if you like do it through a church, you can pay like a lower, like less, it's less than $100. I know that. And you get like I think it's 8 weeks of this course, and you get a workbook and you get all of these things. Right. And he has some conservative kind of views on the economy and on politics that do appeal to a group of people. I would not be one of those people. And sort of like, you know, is just sort of like appeals to like tries to appeal to like working class individuals in a way, but really just like white heterosexual male. Yeah, with lower education and lower income, right?
When you tie in the religious component to it, it starts to make a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that now takes it out of logic, mm-hmm. and ties it to the huge emotionality of faith and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that can make a lot of sense in that if you see deviating from truth, even if it's what once was truth, to changing it, that can be, I mean, within that system, that's not allowed. So it makes sense that it would not be allowed in this system too.
Right.
So
it's sort of a joining together of the two.
Well, Jillian, we are out of time. Where can people contact you?
Yeah, sure. So my website is Her Financial Therapy. So HER financialtherapy.com. I'm on Instagram @HerFinancialTherapy. And you can also shoot me an email at Jillian, J-I-L-L-I-A-N, at herfinancialtherapy.com.
Great. Jillian, thanks so much.
Yeah, it's been
a part of the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, really.
Take care, and we'll talk to everybody next week.
Thanks for joining me, Rick Kaler, for another episode of Financial Therapy. It's not just about the money. This is where I combine the nuts and bolts of financial advice with the emotions that drive making them. Remember, every financial behavior, whether it appears illogical to you or others, makes perfect sense when we understand the underlying beliefs, feelings, and thoughts. Sign up for my weekly blog at financialawakenings.com. I hope you'll join me again for our next episode.